This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. For years, social media companies have tied themselves in knots to avoid muting, freezing, or outright banning Donald Trump. They slapped his messages with warning labels. They flagged posts as being inaccurate or disputed. They even drafted a set of special policies for world leaders. But when the president incited a mob to attack the Capitol building, and when he was less than 2 weeks away from being out of office, big tech finally cracked. Twitter banned him from their platform permanently. His Facebook account has been frozen for the remainder of his term. And late last night, YouTube suspended the president's account for at least 1 week, citing the ongoing potential for violence. It's getting booted from your favorite platform the same as violating your right to free speech. And even if it's not, are we comfortable with private companies having this much control over what we can say and where? Let's get into it. Rynell Anderson-Jones is a professor of law at the University of Utah. She's also an affiliated fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. Rynell, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Also with us, Andrew Marantz, a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's also the author of Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, I'll start with you. Is taking away someone's preferred method of communication the same as violating their right to free speech?
No, it's not. I think that, you know, these are private companies. They have the right to do as they choose. And you know, we can get into this, but it's actually the companies have a First Amendment right to moderate their platforms as they see fit. That being said, it is, I think, as you said in your intro, a bit troubling that these companies have so much power. There are antitrust questions about whether these companies are monopolies. There are questions about whether it's just, you know, apart from the legal questions, whether it's just civically a good state of affairs to have companies have this much power. So I understand why people are troubled by this, whether or not they're Trump supporters. But no, it's not technically a First Amendment violation. And, you know, the fact is, these companies have always had policies. And as you say, Trump and others have always broken them. And that's always been a tension that they have never convincingly been able to resolve.
At this moment, what other options does the president have to get his message out?
Oh, he has plenty of options. He's the president. So he has a press corps that travels with him wherever he goes. He could go to the White House briefing room wherever he whenever he wants. Now, of course, that will all go away in 8 days, but he's still, you know, the most famous person in the world. So I think that a lot of the histrionics about how, you know, big tech has this Orwellian power to, you know, disappear someone, that may be true in other cases, but it's certainly not true of Donald Trump. Now, again, that being said, taking him off Twitter and Facebook and YouTube is still an important step. I don't want to downplay that. And I think it's, if anything, a step that's been taken way too late. That's not because he's now silenced and no one will ever know what Donald Trump thinks ever again, but it's because he's being taken out of the flow of that particular conversation. And, you know, tech companies have always spoken out of two sides of their mouth on this question. When they're asked by, you know, advertisers who want to give them money, they say, well, we've revolutionized communication and we've changed everything about how people think and how people behave. And then when they're asked about their negative impacts on, let's say, political speech, they say, oh, we have nothing to do with that. We're just a mirror that reflects back human nature. And so I think given that dichotomy, which has always been unsupportable, I think that tells you why it's important when someone like the president is banned from a platform like Twitter or YouTube, because these are powerful platforms, and taking them out of the flow of that conversation means that their power is at least removed in some sense, if not entirely vanished.
Rynell, let's zoom way out for a minute and do, you know, a free speech 101. What does the Constitution have to say about the right to free speech?
Yeah, he's right that there's no actual First Amendment problem here. The wider debate about whether we do better to have a richer variety of voices in these private platforms where so much of our community conversation takes place is an important one. But there's no First Amendment problem because the First Amendment, like all of the U.S. Constitution, applies only to government. It's a set of rules about what government can do vis-a-vis its citizens. It says the government cannot censor you, but it doesn't bar Facebook or Twitter or Parler from censoring you using the terms and conditions that you agreed to when you first signed up for their platform. I think we've conflated the two ideas in a lot of really complicated ways. But under the current doctrine, you have to have what we call a state actor, somebody who is the government acting against you, restricting your speech, restricting any of your rights before the Constitution is implicated.
How does the freedom of speech apply to the president of the United States? Because as we said at the beginning, these tech companies have really been loath to crack down on the president up until now.
Yeah, they've been incredibly careful, in part because of the newsworthiness component that's going on here. I mean, on the one hand, if the president is engaging in defamatory or racist or inciting or dangerous speech, that speech does the same harm as it would do if anyone else was speaking in those ways. Indeed, arguably more because of the hugeness of his following and the vastness of his impact. But on the other hand, that speech is unquestionably newsworthy and of public concern. It's first-person manifestation of the president's state of mind and his character, and at least arguably, makes the people aware that their president is engaging in defamatory, racist, inciting dangerous ways. And the thinking goes, it's both critical to self-governance and spurs these important conversations about how the next election should go and what action people might need to take about a person who's acting in a particular way in their name, which is why, as you described, the social media platforms for such a long time walked this very fine line of labeling or removing in the George Floyd summer protests and in response to tweets casting doubt on free and fair election and misinformation about COVID, trying to label or hide individual messages, and really only after the siege of the Capitol and the shift of government power to Democrats did they more fully respond, in part because of this newsworthiness problem.
Well, one of you sent us this text. It says, I think this could be a dangerous precedent no matter how much we might believe in a specific instance. Should social media companies regulate truth and morality? I do believe sedition is a possible exception, but I don't think controlling free speech should ever be taken lightly. Andrew, your thoughts?
I think it's totally right that it should not be taken lightly. I think the way I would slightly reframe that is to say there has never been a choice about this. There's never been an option for pure neutrality, that these companies could somehow not be legislating truth and morality. This is what they do. They control the speech on their platforms. If they choose to do nothing to rein it in, that is also a choice. There's no such thing as neutrality. So it's not as if we've gone along until now without setting a precedent. We've been setting precedents all along. And these platforms all have terms of service. You're not allowed to post nudity. You're not allowed to post violent threats, all the rest of it. And again, when they allowed someone, because he was powerful and famous, to break those rules, that was also setting a precedent. And I think we're just a little, look, I get the slippery slope argument that if we silence this person, what will that lead to? And it might lead to things that we might not like as much. I think that's valid. But I think we should also think about the slippery slope argument of what happens if we don't cause harmful speech to be diminished on these platforms. What will the next riot look like? What will the next war look like? So I think we just have to be able to hold both things in our minds. And if we think that speech has real harm associated with it, we can't just wave that away because we think speech should be free in some abstract sense.
Ronil, your thoughts. Andrew mentioned the terms and services agreement that we all, or many of us, just sort of scroll past when we sign on to these platforms and click OK and go about our lives without really understanding or thinking about what those agreements say.
I think that's right. And I think the latest episodes are causing ordinary Americans to be pushed to think about things that scholars and commentators have been worried about for quite some time, which is that our free speech environment is largely in the hands of organizations that aren't particularly transparent or accountable to us, at least not in the way that, say, our government officials are expected to be. But they now have a huge amount of control over everything from our political climate to our social norms to our individual liberties and our ability to get basic, objectively true, shared information about an election or a pandemic. They for sure have market incentives to try to do those things well, but they might have other incentives too. And we haven't done nearly enough thinking about how they're the new public square, and we've just not yet fully tussled with what that means legally. I agree, and I see that sort of even folks who are largely comfortable with the restrictions in the current case have been given pause about what it could portend for the future, right? The question in free speech areas is always whether we would be comfortable if it were some other speaker who was deplatformed in this same way. And I do think the worry is about others who are less powerful and have fewer available avenues who might find themselves targeted by social media companies for political or other reasons and lose their voice with little explanation or recourse. And this is going to launch important conversations about how much speech on matters of public concern now takes place on these private platforms where the rules are made by profit-seeking companies in ways that we might not have full control over, how utterly central they are to self-government, to our system of checks and balances, to the most valuable and most harmful speech that we engage in.
We're talking about President Trump getting banned from major social media websites. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo explains the importance of creating a safe space for therapy.
I can't tell you how many times I've had clients that say that expression, like, I've never told that to anybody. That's when I know I've made some kind of momentous move with this person. They feel safe enough to expose that part of themselves, and doing that together with somebody else can be very powerful.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
This is 1A. We're discussing the relationship between big tech companies and free speech. Let's get back to the conversation. And a quick bit of news here. Airbnb has announced that it's blocking and canceling reservations in D.C. during inauguration week. A spokesperson says, in response to various officials asking people not to travel to Washington, D.C., we are announcing that Airbnb will cancel reservations in the Washington, D.C. metro area during the inauguration week, adding, we are continuing our work to ensure hate group members are not part of the Airbnb community. Andrew, President Trump isn't the only person getting banned from social media. Platforms are also cracking down on insurrectionists and QAnon accounts. Why are they doing this now? And will these accounts come back?
I mean, my flip answer is the reason they're doing this now is because their MO is to, frankly, wait until there is unignorable harm and then kind of do the bare minimum to backpedal. I mean, that's a little bit too glib, but yeah, this is what I've been seeing for years now, and the reason that I wrote a book about this stuff that was narrative reporting, that wasn't just an argument saying this is why social media is bad, but was really trying to get into how bad actors can infiltrate and manipulate these networks, is that this has always been a dynamic process. There's always been not only a game of cat and mouse, but a sense in which the extremists and the techno-utopians are kind of unwittingly on the same side, because they are both playing the game of getting as much engagement and getting as much online, racking up the numbers as high as they can go. So obviously, the companies don't like to think of themselves that way. They like to think of themselves as the enforcers. But for a long time, they were simply thinking of themselves as laissez-faire non-arbiters, and they allowed this stuff to fester to the point where now they're banning some of the most egregious actors, but a lot of people feel it's too little too late.
What do you make of the argument that by banning people, these companies are not making them go away? They're just being corralled into their own corners of the internet where maybe their ideologies, their plans are going, you know, less noticed?
That's an argument. And I think it's a real argument. You know, when these things go underground, especially when they go onto end-to-end encrypted networks like Telegram and Signal and stuff, that means that this whole conversation about content moderation goes out the window, right? Because not only are the companies not willing to moderate things at that point, they're not able to. They can't even see the content. So there are obviously costs to that. I've heard some people describe it as the analogy of, you know, when the reign of Saddam Hussein falls and then it breaks up into rebel groups like ISIS. I mean, that's obviously an extreme analogy, but, you know, rather than having a government out in the open and coordinating its activities, you have these kind of underground cells. So that sounds terrible, but unfortunately, the alternative is not great either, because the alternative is to have these things keep being out in the open where they can proliferate and keep recruiting new people. And part of how things like January 6th happen is that when people are coordinating out in the open, it's much easier for everyone to get on the same page. So what you have is a trade-off. You, by pushing these things underground, you do potentially allow them to fester and get more extreme, but you don't allow them to find new recruits as easily. You don't allow them to get on the same page as easily. So I think it's a question of breadth versus depth.
Ronnell, in one case, a whole platform was deplatformed. Apple, Google, Amazon all booted the far-right social media app Parler from their hosting platform, though it's since found a new home. What are the legal implications there?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the First Amendment doctrine as it now sits, there the same sorts of arguments that we were discussing before apply here. That is to say, the corporation has the right to make its own determinations about who it wants to contract with and engage in business with. There are slightly more concerns maybe in the broader free speech environment context. If the set of options is very small, or the set of companies sort of marking the line between you existing as a viable social media app or not is very small, then we might have a greater concern about the free speech environment being impacted when we're not just talking about a particular voice not being heard on a particular platform, but rather a particular platform not existing at all. But in terms of First Amendment doctrine, aren't in a place where there is a First Amendment requirement for any company to do so. And in fact, it's in some respects an interesting turn of events that conservative voices in this moment are deeply concerned about the companies that are in the business of speech and expression being permitted to exclude speech that they prefer not to be associated with. A lot of the most recent cases before the Supreme Court focused on the First Amendment rights of corporate speakers that have been championed by that side of the aisle.
Well, we have this question from Pat on Twitter, who says, what responsibility do our legislators have to make sure the people of our nation are not misled by unvetted media sources with false information and conspiracy theories? And Andrew, just first briefly talk about the proliferation of misinformation and disinformation on these social media platforms.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting enough to track for a few years, and I watched it grow not only in scale, but in sophistication. You know, in the early days, these systems were not at all hard to game, systems being like Twitter and YouTube and Reddit and all the rest of them, because their incentives were very, very clear. So it was all about engagement. That's the only thing that the algorithms know how to track, and it's the only thing the algorithms promote. There's no part of the algorithm that promotes for civic virtue or integrity or truth. It promotes what people are clicking on and commenting on and sharing, and that tracks very closely with what is creating the most immediate spike of what is called in the social science literature activating emotion. And some of those emotions are positive and some of those emotions are negative. The negative ones are easier to incite and make things easier to spread. So that's the basic mechanic of how all of these networks work, and the basic underlying mechanic hasn't changed. So my sort of rule of thumb as a reporter and observer of this stuff is that once you're talking about a specific case of should this or that group or this or that person be banned, it's kind of too late because the underlying mechanics that made that group popular and powerful are still in place. So I think if you want to talk about how to protect the citizens of this country from rampant misinformation and bigotry and all kinds of the brain warping effects of the way we've built our informational ecosystem, I actually don't think it's sufficient or even possible for legislators to do that work. I think in part it's not possible for precisely the First Amendment reasons we've been discussing. If the government were to somehow try to take on the work of deciding what is true or false, that would raise very troubling First Amendment implications, because as Professor Jones pointed out, that would be about how the government treats its citizens, and I don't think it would pass muster pretty much any way you orchestrated it. I think it is the responsibility of these companies to rebuild themselves from the ground up. Now, the government could break up the companies, and the government could retool Section 230. There are a lot of things the government could and arguably should do, but having a Ministry of Information to decide what's true, that's not going to be the way to do it. I think it's on the companies primarily to retool their algorithms and their incentive structures so that we don't keep sliding down this dangerous path.
Ronnell, other countries have independent media regulators, but what do you think would work or be most effective here in the U.S.?
Yeah, this is a massive point of contention within the communications and media law scholarly world at the moment. And every time we have conversations about models that seem to have been successful in other places, we run up against the fact that other places simply do not have a First Amendment of the sort that we have, or the heavy thumb on the scale pro-free speech and anti-government regulation of the communication space. I think part of what we have to do here is really have a serious conversation about the ways that the Trump presidency illuminated the changing dynamic between presidents and the press. On the one hand, it made it feasible for the president to cut out some of the communication intermediaries that other presidents had to rely really heavily upon, making it possible for him to speak, you know, more directly to his followers. On the other hand, it also cut out some of the core democracy-enhancing functions that those intermediaries used to serve, fact-checking and verifying and pressing for details and following up for policy specifics. And the loss of those functions can be really damaging to the flow of information on matters of concern in a democracy, and we haven't adequately tussled with what to do about that shift and how to reinvigorate what we think of as the press function in this very new media landscape.
We'll be back with more from our guests and you after a quick break. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Driftwell. Sip into relaxation with Driftwell, who believes a well-rested world is a better world. That's why they created Driftwell, an enhanced still water beverage designed with evening relaxation in mind. With 10% of your daily magnesium, a hint of blackberry lavender flavor, and L-theanine, it's designed to help you relax and unwind. Driftwell is a non-carbonated beverage with no sugar or calories. It's a whole new way to cap off your day.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
Let's get back to our conversation with this email from Val, who says Trump is not being arbitrarily banned. He violated policies that predated his use of Twitter, for example. Anyone fomenting violence is subject to banning. He should not be held to a different standard. And we received this text: when speech incites violence, I feel platforms have an obligation to remove that speech. Ronnell, what does the First Amendment say about violence?
Yeah, the First Amendment doctrine is incredibly speaker protective on this front. We do have an exception to the ordinary First Amendment rules prohibiting restrictions on freedom of speech when the speech is incitement. But the standard that the court has established in that space means that incitement doesn't just mean that you spoke about something or even that you urged something or discussed something or motivated people to act in a particular way. There's a temporal requirement that's quite immediate that needs to exist. And so it's difficult. It's been difficult in the case law for incitement as a standard to be demonstrated. That said, the standards that these social media companies have for speech encouraging violence is much softer than that. And they're acting wholly within their policies to shut down speech that they don't want to be affiliated with that that might have that kind of effect, that might glorify or advance violent motives or criminal activities on the part of other people.
Well, and how much do tech companies need to be concerned about their own liability if they allow this speech on their platforms?
Thanks to Section 230, a statutory provision that no one really talked about in the real world until Donald Trump made it very central, they don't have to worry a great deal. This law is a law that Congress wrote to give platforms and indeed all websites and internet service providers immunity for the harmful speech of their users. So if you defame me on Facebook, I can sue you for libel, but I can't sue Facebook for publishing the libel. And the goal here at the time was a really admirable one, right? To recognize some of the logistical difficulties involved in moderating massive amounts of content in what was then the new internet world, and also to foster as broad a free speech environment as possible by, you know, diminishing the incentives that these providers might otherwise have had to take down lots of material in the name of erring on the side of legal safety. There's an interesting and I think important debate happening amongst people on both sides of the political aisle about whether that broad immunity is still a wise route and what sorts of free speech cultural consequences has come about as a result of it. But their own liability is quite limited in this space.
Where does the First Amendment come into play when it comes to misinformation or disinformation right now?
There certainly is a body of case law that makes it possible for lies to be regulated, but even that space is quite limited. So, for example, we have libel law and the constitutionalization of libel law from the United States Supreme Court making clear that particularly when the people who are involved in a libel action are public figures or public officials, we have a great deal of freedom to say things that are even false and defamatory in the name of having a broad swath of information and a dialogue that is robust about our public figures. And so this was another complaint that we heard pretty consistently throughout the Trump presidency, Trump arguing that libel law in this country is too protective of speakers, and particularly too protective of speakers who are speaking about matters of public concern. We don't have really great mechanisms for shutting down false speech in this country. And in part, this is because we have built a body of doctrine that presupposes something called a marketplace of ideas, the notion that true speech will counter false speech and will win the day. And again, we have a major question about whether now that we are in a space where much easier and much wider distribution of both unintentional misinformation and purposeful disinformation is possible, whether those doctrines that were built in an earlier era remain sound.
So, you know, if we look at where we are right now, there's been months and months of widespread, totally false claims of election fraud that have permeated many right-wing accounts. So is the tipping point the possible spiraling into violence? Is that why we're at this moment where people are being deplatformed, where the president himself has been removed from these platforms?
I think there are a couple of tipping points. I mean, one tipping point is plainly that we saw not only the circulation of this misinformation and disinformation, but we're learning that social media was an organizing tool for at least some folks with violent or otherwise illegal goals in the siege, and that they used it in concrete criminal ways. And there's a desire on the part of these platforms not to foster what might be the next major act of violence at this very tense time in the lead up to the inauguration. But I also think if we're speaking in practical, concrete terms, there is also, it also came about at the exact moment that the Democrats solidified their control in D.C., right? Once we saw that there would be Democratic control of the White House and of the Senate, that shifts the thinking about these matters from one policy realm to another policy realm and may well have spurred these companies to move in that direction as well.
I want to play this voicemail one of you left for us.
My name is Joe, calling from Central Florida, and I fully support the right of free speech, but I do not support the right to yell fire in a crowded theater or any other speech that would tend to harm someone else physically, financially, or emotionally.
Joe, thanks for that message. Ernie also tweets, free speech has always had responsible limits. We should not expect theater owners to hand out megaphones to every fool who yells fire. And this is an example we hear used quite a bit. You can't yell fire in a theater. But Ronnell, I think there's an argument to be made that the threat of violence isn't or hasn't been new. If you go online, you'll see many people complaining about receiving direct threats of violence from people on these platforms, and the social media companies didn't respond.
I think that's right. I think the contours of this were playing out in plain sight for a very long time. We perhaps didn't have as notable a manifestation of them as we had at this sort of critical moment when all eyes were on America and its capital being sieged. But we certainly have known, and scholars and commentators have been identifying for years, that these kinds of violent, angry, misogynistic lines of speech have happened in very significant ways that have ramped up in all the ways that Andrew discusses in his book, because these new sets of tools have been made available to them. The question is whether we will use this moment to make sound policy that thinks about the entire set of data that we have about what's happened from the inception of these companies to the present, or whether we'll react in a flash way that responds only to the immediate political moment and doesn't set into place broader institutional structural fixes that are necessary in this new public square.
I want to play one more voicemail we received.
My name is John. I'm from Albert Lea, Minnesota. And I think my biggest fear is the knee-jerk reaction to hate speech and such. The freedom of speech in this country is extremely fragile, and there are many groups that would love to limit freedom of speech to within parameters that they're comfortable with. And so the biggest fear is that as much as hate speech is reprehensible, censorship and trying to limit what can be said can be even more dangerous in the long run.
Andrew, what's your take on this? How are social media companies grappling with this?
Yeah, I think, again, we need to be able to hold both slippery slope concerns in our heads at once. So I think the caller is right that there's a concern about too much censorship. I think that there has to also be obviously a concern about a complete lack of what would not be called censorship, but would be called moderation, because you just can't have one concern without the other. You can't worry about what happens if we try to shut down dangerous, threatening authoritarians without worrying about what happens if we don't, right? And obviously, we're living in the kind of perilous moment that can show you one version of what happens when you don't, and it could have been worse. I mean, I think to the earlier discussion about when there might have been a tipping point, I think Professor Jones is absolutely right. People have been warning about this for a long time, and if I had to put a number to when the tipping point was, I would think it would be probably 2015 or so. And a lot of what you're seeing now is kind of almost not inevitable, but it's sort of baked in given the amount of damage we've done to our informational system years prior. I think it's actually sort of useful to think about the climate crisis as an analogy. you know, we've pumped so much carbon into our atmosphere now that we're going to be dealing with the fallout of that for years to come, even if we cut emissions to zero right now. And I think that's a useful analogy, because when people like the caller bring up the slippery slope of censorship, I think, you know, let's think about it from the climate analogy. There is a danger to regulating businesses to the point where they can't make a profit. I take that seriously. But if we do nothing, then we don't have a planet anymore, right? And I think there's something similar happening in the information space. If you just completely derange and scramble the information ecosystem to make it addictive and full of disinformation and frankly just warp people's brains until we can't come to any kind of consensus and until we're basically tearing each other apart and tearing our civic fabric apart, then yeah, you've avoided the problem of too much censorship, but you have caused another set of problems that I think is at least as dangerous.
That's Andrew Marantz. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Anti-Social, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Also with us, Ronnell Anderson-Jones, a professor of law at the University of Utah and an affiliated fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. Ronnell, Andrew, thanks for your time. Today's conversation was produced by James Morrison and Katie Klein. It was edited by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.